Welcome to TNT's Hit Songs from Mars, where we unravel the stories behind some of pop's most unlikely hits.
From simple curiosities to songs that changed the world, we examine the socio-political and cultural factors that contributed to the success of these surprising outliers.
And the impact these songs had on society. I'm Tom Thompson.
And I'm Tyler Ralston. And together we're
TNT.
Hey T, how's it going?
Hey Tom, how are you?
I'm pretty good.
You're sporting the orange sunglasses today.
Yeah. I thought it was kind of in the, you know, the festive season, the orange season, the orange and green. I look outside my window and there's orange and green leaves. Most of them are gone now, but yeah. Truthfully, I'm horrible at keeping sunglasses, and I don't really deserve to own good sunglasses because I just leave them everywhere.
Yeah, you wouldn't want a $200 pair of sunglasses that you would just leave somewhere.
Yeah, I know, I'm pretty bad. So I bought these at the Norwood Fair when I was visiting at my parents' cottage. And we have some news there that my parents have sold their cottage. It's an end of an era.
Indeed it is. I miss the place, even though I haven't been there in 20 years. Jeez, who knows?
Has it been that long?
I don't know. It's been a long time.
Yeah, I guess they were there almost 30, and they lived there for a lot of those years. 20, probably.
Yeah, it was quite a place.
Yeah, and I'm in the midst of closing up my cottage, so it's a bit, you know, it's a bit sad.
Cottaging season comes to an end. You know, Canada is the only country where to cottage is a verb.
Yeah, it's funny. It's so kind of ubiquitous in our culture. I think I forget that it's not something that everyone has, and I feel very privileged that I've always had one to go to.
Yeah, certainly not everyone could afford one. That's for sure.
Yeah, and I remember talking to an American. I can't remember where he was from. I just met him just kind of in passing, but you know, there was talk about, oh, you know, my parents are probably gonna have to sell their cottage. And he was like, don't let it leave the family. He was very, clear about that. And, I guess, yeah, I don't know. He just recognized how special it is to have a family cottage to go to.
It can also wreck families, how the inheritance of a cottage shakes down, where often the values of these things are more than all the kids together can actually afford, and someone wants to opt out. You know, they bought it for $5,000. It's worth $1 million now. I mean, it just gets weird.
It's true. And even the taxes get so extreme that
you're paying rent.
Yeah.
You're paying rent. It's so high. I get it.
Yeah, exactly. It that is sad. And you know, it's funny that you'd say that because we, this came along long after you were at Belmont Lake, but there's actually a brewery on the lake now.
No kidding. And they like use the lake water to
they do
beer.
Yeah, they do actually. And I had a good chat with the brewmaster there. This British couple who came to Canada and started a brewery right on the lake, which I think is so cool because you can just get in your canoe and paddle over and you know, dock your canoe and then go up and have a pint, or you can go and take out, you know, they kind of sell these big jugs that you can take away, and it's really good beer, like really very British style ales, etc.
Yeah, it sounds amazing, really.
Yeah. So, but the funny thing was that we got to talking about beer, and I said, "Oh, do you actually? What's your water source?" And he looks at the lake, and I said, "Oh, that's great." And he said, "Yeah, it's amazing because I guess you might know more than I do because you actually spent quite a bit of time making beer, I believe. But there's something about a correct pH level that you have to ensure you have." Yeah. And he said that the lake water is, after it's filtered, obviously,
yeah,
is the perfect pH.
Far
which
out.
Means you don't have to add, I don't know, I can't, I don't know, maybe you know, like there's something you needed to add something if the pH was off.
Yeah, I mean, the cleaner the going in, the better the beer is probably going to be.
Yeah. So we kind of, we went for our farewell paddle over to the brewery as well, and such nice people. And weirdly, there was gossip about, oh, someone sold their cottage in the lake. and to make it less awkward, we were like, oh, that's actually our parents. So
they give you a pint for free?
They didn't, but we'd already paid for our pints at that point. But okay. We did. I picked up my Belmont Brewery shirt and some swag as a reminder. And then it kind of, I don't know,
a little merch.
Yeah, it was funny because I don't know why going to the brewery kind of it solidified in my mind, like, oh yeah, the cottage, like, that's it. Like, we can't, you know what I mean? You just think it's just such a mainstay for us. And then suddenly it occurred to me, I'm like, oh, I can't just paddle up to the brewery anymore.
No, well, that's a pretty unique situation too, where one can paddle to the brewery.
Definitely. Yeah. Have you heard of Madison Cunningham?
No.
I discovered this artist listening to an interview with Greg Lease, kind of one of my favorite steel players and someone who's really broken through into the mainstream, pushing the pedal steel out of its cubbyhole in the country realm. He mentioned this person, Madison Cunningham, is kind of like an up and comer. And, you know, I mean, I think she's already sort of pretty well established, but, I find her really interesting. One of the things she does is she tunes her guitar down really low to a C.
That's pretty low. And she must like Tony Iommi a lot.
Yeah. But it's such an interesting mix of influences. There's kind of a little bit of a jazz element. There's obviously a rock element. I just find it quite unique. And I'm just going to play a little bit of a song. And actually, I actually have a video.
Okay.
And I think if we're to believe what's happening in the video, I think she plays all the instruments.
You'll never see me dying on screen or microscope. I'll be the first to laugh it off, to not be the brunt of your joke. Let me make a mistake, it'll pay for its own cost. 'Cause regret is like an infant that won't let you sleep it off.
Yeah, I dig it.
It's cool, eh? I love the sound. It's interesting too, what she does. And it's funny because I've never ever wanted to ever put a chorus effect on my guitar.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, she kind of makes me want to do that. Because she's got, I think, like a chorus and or vibrato or tremolo going all the time. And it does kind of add this cool dimension to her guitar sound.
I find chorus, again, any sound effect on a guitar, any effect pedal, the right dosage is essential, but I like a good chorus.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty neat. And it's funny, you know, it's funny because it's almost like we kind of talked about this, like sort of limitations and things that happen that are positive through sort of just the nature of imperfections in a sense. But I remember having this conversation with a guy about, I was telling him about how, you know, you can put a guitar in Nashville tuning.
Yeah.
You know what that is?
Sure.
Yeah. So it's like the high strings of a 12 string guitar. And I was kind of saying, well, it's great because, you know, you have better control. So you record an acoustic or whatever, with, you know, a standard acoustic, and then you record a Nashville tune acoustic, and then you have much more control and it's in better in tune and all that stuff. And this person pointed out to me, I'm like, but part of the magic is actually the out of tuneness that happens. There's a little bit of a warbly effect, right? And it's like, unless you have an individual saddle on your 12 string, because the intonation of a guitar is all determined by the distance of the nut to the saddle, right?
Right.
So if you have two strings, a thick string and a thin string on the same saddle, it's just inherently going to be, the intonation is going to be a little bit out. And you would think that's a disadvantage, but I actually think it's part of the magic.
No, it's human. It keeps it human. I mean, you don't want, if something's too clean, you sort of pick up on that as well.
Yeah, like try to imagine the sound of an accordion. I don't even understand how they do it on an accordion, but it's got that weird warbly effect.
Well, first of all, it's literally half a step out of tune.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, it's made that way. I just, because I know some accordion players, and I'm going to tune this correctly, and it didn't work. Like something was wrong, so he tuned it back down to where it was supposed to be.
Oh, interesting.
But it creates a unique situation. It keeps it human. It keeps it real somehow. But with this girl's guitar playing, the thing that comes to mind, it's cool, but does it run the risk of being a novelty? And the first thing that comes to mind is our discussion very recently, in fact, about the Crash Test Dummies, Brad Roberts. And, you know, it's cool, you know, the voice in this guitar. I mean, how many albums would you want to hear this very low strung guitar? Or is it good for a song or two? I mean, it's a question.
It's an excellent point. And I think the good thing is that she doesn't use it as a crutch. So it's not, and I don't even think she uses it all the time.
Yeah,
she
that does, makes sense.
Apparently dosages. She uses the slight warbly effect all the time, but I don't think if you listen to her other song, first of all, she's very eclectic and her other songs sound very different from this. So I totally understand what you're saying, but I don't think she's at risk of that.
Because, the right dosage would be just fine then.
Yeah, exactly. All right, T. Well, speaking of keeping it real.
So what do you got for us today?
We're ready to move into
our hit song from Mars.
We are. So we've had our hit song from Earth, and now we're ready to move on to our hit song from Mars. Can you tell what it is from the beat?
Nope.
Oh.
Okay.
Now you must.
I know the song. It's not jumping right at me, though.
Did you figure out what the band is?
No, I have no idea. I've heard the song, but I don't know the band. I mean, my instincts say Smashing Pumpkins or something like that.
Okay.
But I don't know it.
That's fascinating. So it's actually Blur.
Okay.
And maybe you're not super familiar with Blur.
I am not.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting because obviously in the UK, they're just a massive band. And of course... in the battle of Britpop, they used to call it the infamous wars between Blur and Oasis over the charts, the chart battle, as they called it.
Okay, so it's a Rolling Stones, Beatles, contemporary kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Where do you stand on that, by the way?
Oh, it's Rolling Stones.
Really, eh?
Oh, hell yeah.
Wow. I mean...
That's a big discussion right there.
It is.
Beatles versus the Stones.
If you compare them on a musical level, the Beatles win, I would argue. But if you compare them on a vibe level, you know.
I'll agree with that. I mean, the Beatles definitely expanded outward into more directions. A lot of the stuff was more complex, whereas the Stones, I guess you could almost say they held their ground as sort of a rock blues bar band that just got enormous.
Yeah. I have a theory about the Stones. I think a lot of the success of the Stones is Keith Richards tuning his guitar to open
to G.
Yeah. I think that's a huge, I think as soon as you change the tuning of guitar, it opens up all kinds of, different sonic possibilities than other people are exploring. And, I really think it's, I don't know. There's a bunch of bands who swear by it, you know, Sonic Youth being one of them. And to the point where I think they had to, you know, have like 18 guitars on tour, not because they're, you know, guitar maniacs, but because each one was in a different tuning for each song.
And didn't Sonic Youth also, at least there was one album where they literally played the same, all the songs they were playing on the album, but with like over 100 different guitars into the soundboard. Just same thing.
I wouldn't be surprised. Guitars. I wouldn't be surprised. And the other thing that they do that's really cool, and it's totally in keeping with what we were saying about accordions, is they would detune them slightly to create that little bit of a more of a menacing, you might say, sound of not being in perfect pitch.
Yeah. Bauhaus did the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I'll tell you a little bit. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to make one more comment. I mean, we can come back to the Beatles and Stones and all that. Mm-hmm. But where it really, really worked, Keith Richards doing his tuning, which made for really nice. He really had that mastered. And then the Mick Jones era with the lead. Those two things together were just made it spectacular.
Mick Jones
was Clash or
That's right.
Sex Pistols or something.
Another
like
great
that.
Guitar player, but yeah. No, I love Mick Taylor's playing too.
Oh yeah, he's phenomenal. I think my favorite Stone song of all time is one called Soul Survivor. It's this little known one at the end of Exile on Main Street. It's different than any other Stone song I've ever heard, but that's the one I can listen to endlessly.
Yeah, there's one on that record that I really love. What's the name? Shine a Light. I love his playing on that. It's beautiful.
A gospel-esque song, if I'm remembering it correctly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, the funny thing about him was he quit the Stones, I would argue, at the end of their best period, because he kind of thought they were a joke, musicianship-wise.
Yeah, and then had already contributed to their peak years.
Yeah, funny.
A little harsh, perhaps, but that was their peak. I agree. Somewhere like Sticky Fingers. Exile on Main Street, and I think Goat's Head Soup was next, although that album wasn't anything to write home about.
Mm-hmm, agreed.
But I think he played on that one too.
Yeah.
Maybe just spotted a general, okay, this is going downhill from here. I'm going to bail while the getting's good.
Right, yeah, could be.
Because, the 70s and the Stones were just, that was kind of a, they were in the wilderness for, Miss You, Give Me a Break. I mean, jeez. I've been holding out so long. I've been sleeping all alone. Don't I miss you? I've been hanging on the phone. I've been sleeping all alone. I won't kiss you. It's all the way till Start Me Up where they have any flicker of, oh, okay, I can at least tolerate this song.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah. What would your favorite era of the Beatles be?
Oh, that's easy. Abbey Road.
Okay.
I like a lot of their songs, but I don't know if I'd sit through a whole Beatles album except for Abbey Road.
Yeah.
Don't say Rubber Soul because, that seems to be one everyone absolutely loves. It doesn't do anything for me.
Right.
What's your favorite Beatles?
I don't know. It's funny because growing up, we basically had the Red Album and the Blue Album, right? There were those compilations that was kind of like
The
best of the early 62 to 66 or something, or something like that.
Yeah, the Love Me Do era in the psychedelic era.
Yeah, I definitely preferred the Blue Albums, but it's funny because I really just knew those hits growing up. And in some ways, I'm actually just kind of discovering the albums now. And I mean, some of the songs are pretty weak. let's be straight.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're probably going to get hate mail for this, but, there's a lot, every album has some incredibly strong songs on it, but yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's kind of like
filler.
Yeah.
Did you just say filler?
I did.
Yeah. We said it at the same time.
We did.
See? Yeah, definitely. You get that rare album where there isn't filler. Like again, I'll argue Abbey Road. I mean, there's some strong songs that are stronger than others, but it's a pretty unique, interesting piece, especially that medley. That's really cool on side B.
Yeah, that's true. That is pretty neat. So then you're saying you're not very familiar with Blur. Would you be much more familiar with Oasis then, I guess?
No.
Okay.
I just never an Oasis fan, so.
Yeah, okay.
You're flying solo on this one here.
Okay. No problem. I got this. You'll just have to swallow everything I say without questioning it.
Fair enough. Or I'll drag it into some realm I'm more familiar with. I'll just be waiting for my entry point. So go ahead. Start on Blur.
Okay. So Blur, they were pretty, they defined Britpop in that era. I would say, well, Oasis and Blur kind of defined Britpop.
So we're talking 90s, mid-90s, post-grunge?
Yeah. They would have started playing, I think, in 88 or 89. 88, actually, I think. And then their first record, I believe, came out in 91.
Okay.
They were really young, and they kind of, like, even the name Blur, I can't remember what their name was before that, but basically they signed a deal, and the record company was like, we hate your name. Here's, like, a bunch of names to choose from. And so they actually chose Blur out of that list, which is surprising because they're very strong-minded people. It's amazing. But it just goes to show you, when you're a young artist like that, you're willing to kind of accept what a record
Sell
company
your soul.
Is. Yeah, exactly. So then, you know, they put out, they kind of did become, once their first record came out, became a pretty massive success, and definitely quirky. Like, if you think about the Rolling Stones versus Beatles thing, it actually does fit the Blur versus Oasis thing kind of perfectly, because Blur was a little bit, musicianship wise, a bit more adept and a bit more interesting chord changes, etc. And then, you know, Oasis were just kind of like working class heroes or whatever, you know?
So Oasis is the Stones in this particular battle.
Absolutely.
No kidding. Absolutely. But they're the far bigger band.
Well, no.
Okay.
Not in the UK.
Okay, not in the UK.
Yeah, I guess Oasis did become probably more of a global sensation than Blur.
Okay.
I would say. But anyway, they kind of, just to fast forward ahead to this particular album, I think you should give it a listen. It's a really weird album.
The song.
Yeah, it's a really weird album. And what's interesting is it's the first album where they sort of completely stepped outside of Britpop. And apparently a lot of it had to do with the fact that Graham Coxon, the guitar player, was really getting into American bands, like Pavement, for example, and kind of cited that as a pretty big influence.
So well, cross your T's, shirt smell worse than your lying. Caught my dad crying, loose like the wind from the rough we get.
So it's a really, really weird album. Has, you know, one of my favorite songs by Blur, I would say Beetlebum. It's a beautiful song. Slip away. This song is interesting because it was basically composed as a joke.
Beetlebum was?
No.
Okay.
Song 2. Sorry, yeah. So this song that is featured in this episode is called Song 2.
Okay.
And you can kind of tell by the name of the song that it was maybe just a little bit of a
little tongue-in-cheek
off. Yeah, thing. So basically what happened was Damon Albarn, who's the singer of Blur, had a song just that he kind of had on acoustic guitar. It was quite slow. It did have the sort of basic bones of what the song became, but it was much slower, just on an acoustic guitar, a little quiet, woohoo, you know, like a, and then Graham Coxon stepped in and said, let's really piss off the record company. Let's just totally make this over the top, a joke, just to kind of annoy them. And so they recorded it, and with, you know, as you can hear, it's very extreme between the quiet and loud,
right,
which of course is a formula that I would argue the Pixies kind of pioneered, I would say.
Then it's brought into, you know, worldwide fame with Radiohead, Creep.
Yeah, with Creep. And interestingly, Creep kind of has a similar story, right? The story of Creep is that it was this kind of like drippy, whiny love song. And Johnny Greenwood, same kind of thing, was so annoyed, he started just hitting his guitar and making that signature sound that made Creep so famous. And then that huge guitar. And you could kind of argue it's the same thing that's going on with this song. So it's interesting that, I don't know, I find that so cool, the way these songs could come about. So anyway, back to song two, they presented the song just as a joke, and it was so extreme, the difference between the quiet and the loud. They just thought, oh, well, the record company's going to think it's ridiculous, but the record company was like, this is great. They were joking. They said, Blur was joking and said, when they said they wanted to put it out as a single. And then the record company was like, yeah, let's do it. This is great. And of course the band was just completely flabbergasted because, they just couldn't imagine that it could ever become a hit. And I would argue that it's the song is so ubiquitous now that it seems normal, but it's a pretty weird song to become the hit that it did. The lyrics are basically meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have said that actually the song was a direct, it was basically a parody of a grunge song that they were just jokingly putting out there because, like, oh, this is all these grunge people are doing, is this sort of, you know, put in a huge guitar or whatever, and people won't care if it's kind of a dumb song. So it's kind of funny in a sense, because it really is an anomaly in Blur's whole discography. There isn't much else like it. And so this is kind of an interesting theme I've been exploring, is the songs that were intended as jokes, but then became massive hits. And the list is pretty insane. Beck's Loser was, yeah. So Loser was basically, came about when Beck was sitting at the table, you know, kitchen table with this guy, Carl Stevenson, who was on this label, Rap-A-Lot Records. And basically Beck started just rapping kind of like for fun. And was basically thinking how stupid it sounded. Was basically like, this is so horrible what I'm doing. And then, of course, that completely broke Beck into the mainstream, which is kind of insane. Don't believe everything that you breathe. You get a parking similar, Fight for Your Right to Party by the Beastie Boys was also done as a joke, which again kind of broke them as well. And then the craziest one is Smells Like Teen Spirit was also recorded as a joke. And then, of course, we know what happened there. And it's funny, I never really thought about it, but Kurt Cobain has gone on record and saying it was a total joke. And one of the funny things is the name. Do you know the origin of the name?
Well, yeah, it's teen girl deodorant.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So he came into a room and Kathleen Hanna, another musician, great musician, had spray painted on the wall, "Kurt smells like Teen Spirit." And apparently Kurt thought it was cool, not realizing that there is actually a deodorant called Teen Spirit.
Oh yeah. I remember
that his girlfriend
stuff
at the time wore. So then the song comes about, and then he also kind of joked that the signature riff was his take on Boston's More Than a Feeling.
That's funny. Well, what I'm seeing here, the pattern that you've kind of established, is that there was a shift at some point in record companies where they're not stuffy old businessmen, but looking for something cool. And they may even out-cool the cool band. I mean, and Nirvana might be the perfect example. I mean, it seems to me, I remember in their contract, they were contractually obliged to smash all their instruments on stage every show. And
really?
Yeah. And I think that, they thought it was hilarious for a while, but then after 7 months on tour, it's like, this gets so old. We don't want to do this anymore, but they had to.
Right.
So these are record company decisions. So at that point, I think it might have been easier for bands when they're wrestling with stuffy old record company executives. But then finally, stuffy old record company executives need to have people that, hey, we need people that can identify what is actually going to sell to a certain audience.
Yeah.
And so they might have gotten a little confused at that point. The 90s would be a really good example of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this is exactly what I was thinking. It, at a certain point, these labels actually, they started to know what they're talking about more than the artists. But the problem is, for some of the artists, is that, like, the Beastie Boys completely disavow Fight for Your Right to Party. And in fact, they haven't played it since 1987. So there's a danger in submitting these joke songs to your label, right?
Or songs that the record company pushes. Another, two more. I got two examples for you. Warrant's Cherry Pie.
Mm-hmm.
They cut the album, this pop metal album. And, the record company execs know what they're looking for in a pop metal album. They're like, hey, we really dig this. But it lacks a hit. We need a hit. And Janie Lane, I think the guy's name was, got pissed. He wrote it in 10 minutes. And then they recorded it. It's their biggest hit. But according to the band, it's like then they were stuck with it forever. And they tried to explore other directions, but they're always the Cherry Pie Band.
In that same genre, a similar thing happened with Quiet Riot and Come On, Feel the Noise. It was presented to them as the record company was like, you need to record this song. And the band was completely opposed to it. And in fact, that they actually tried to sabotage it. And weirdly, like, they intentionally tried to sing out of tune, and they didn't really learn the song properly or whatever. But then forgetting that that's actually kind of the spirit of rock and roll, is that we don't give a crap, and you know, we're gonna anyway. It's another funny story like that. And then obviously that was a massive hit for them too. So you think my singing's out of time? It makes me money. I don't know why. I don't know why anymore. I know. So come on, feel the noise. Girls, rock your boys. We'll get wild, wild, wild.
Another one, and we're getting a whole string of these things. Warren Zevon's Werewolves of London. Same thing happened. The record company's like, hey, we dig this. This album needs a hit, though. I mean, we need a hit. And then so the record, the execs are listening to it. And at the end of the album, or one they weren't even going to include, they had already recorded Werewolves of London. And one of the guys like, okay, we're good. And the band got furious, like, no, that song was stupid. We don't want anything to do with it. And they argued about it. It's like, okay, that's a wrap. You guys can go home now. We got our hit. He was looking for the place called Lee Ho Fooks. Gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein. And then the interview with one of the band members I heard later is like, he's like, well, I guess they were right. Mm-hmm. You know, acknowledge that, you know, they saw something that the band didn't. It wasn't their exact style or whatever, but it's like, that's, you know, that kind of balance is important at the end of the day.
I think quite right, said the same thing. And in the end, they were like, oh, they were right. So.
And that was a Slade song, wasn't it? Like from the early 70s. Yeah.
Were you a closet Quiet Riot fan? I did listen to them. You know, Ty, I went to see, I'll never forget, I went to see at the CNE. Did you ever go to the CNE in Toronto?
No.
Canadian National Exhibition. It was like the big, you know, calling it a fair doesn't seem right, but like.
The World's Fair.
Yeah, it's like that. And it happened every summer in Toronto. And I remember, so the bill was... Kickaxe.
Oh yeah, I remember Helix. Them. Kick. Both those two are both Canadian bands, if I'm not mistaken. Canadian. Yeah.
Quiet Riot. And who do you think?
What who, year?
Who? Oh.
Ish.
84 maybe.
Canadian.
No, decidedly not Canadian.
Okay, they needed a headline.
Let's put it this way. What band would get me to go see all those other bands who I didn't particularly like?
The Who?
No. Scorpions, man. The Scorps.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
And I just remember it was crazy because I would say that was kind of like the height of metal, and it was you know, like all these metalheads just took over the CNE. It was so funny to see. It's kind of like this thing where you take your family or whatever, and suddenly it was all these like these rockers with long hair and leather pants, and it was pretty crazy to see.
I'll never forget. I saw one time visiting you guys when we were younger. I went to see Iron Maiden at Maple Leaf Gardens when I was a big Maidenhead. And to get back, you know, I took the subway. So I'm there at Dundas and Young in the subway line. There's just hundreds. I mean, it's packed with metalheads from one end to the other. Train pulls up. There's about four people on it, these older people. The look on their faces when they saw what was about to get on the train. I mean, I think every emotion passed through those faces. Shock, horror, curiosity. And just finally, you know, resignation and I had to deal with this.
It's funny because I actually saw, clearly we didn't go together, but no. I actually saw Iron Maiden at Maple Leaf Gardens too. And my only memory of it was that it sounded horrible. I think it was just like too loud or something. How did it sound when you went?
I hadn't seen a lot of concerts at that point, so it's hard to say, but in retrospect, it was probably the wrong venue for that kind of music.
I don't think it was very, I don't know. I did go to a few shows. I think I actually saw The Who at Maple Leaf Gardens, but like obviously into one of their reunion tours or whatever.
Because their farewell concert was in Toronto, but that was 82.
Yeah, I think that's what I was at. No. It must have been.
I mean, that was their first run, their farewell concert. The first run from, you know, their time in the early 60s to when they disbanded. Yeah.
No, there's no way I was listening to The Who when I was 12. I was more into metal. It must have been a few years later. I remember I went with Beth and maybe Jim.
Oh, right. Once the reunion.
87, maybe, or something like that.
Yeah, once the reunion era begins and all these 60s bands are suddenly packing arenas again. And that never stopped, in a sense.
Yeah. So back to song two, you know, one of the things that I find so funny about this song is, you know, it seems like it was written as a joke. It's probably the song, it was their biggest hit in the US. In the UK, they had hit after hit after hit. But the funny thing about this song is that it's like in hockey arenas and stuff, or like for sports events, it's routinely used as a means to hype up the crowd.
Yeah, those are funny. The little clips that have become standard at sporting events. That one, which I mean, song number two, the beginning of Big Country's Big Country, you hear quite a bit. House of Pain. they were like Irish rap or something.
Along those lines. Jump Around, is that?
Yeah, you know the
jump
one.
Jump Around. Get up and get down.
There's a standard list of them to get the audience excited when there's, heaven forbid, like 3 seconds they've got to deal with they're not being stimulated by the game. Every second has to be filled in.
Yeah, I would love to know what the royalty situation is when your song is being played, even that short 7 second clip or whatever it is, in a stadium of, you know, 40, 50,000 people, like how that works.
That's a good question.
Cause that could be a massive means of money for bands.
And at the very least, I mean, people would, I remember that song. I like it. I'm going to go buy it. You know, something along those lines.
True. Yeah. It's a double whammy. But it's funny, you know, this song, even to this day, it's such a phenomenon. So I was watching this thing on YouTube and it was from Hungary and it's only from, I think, 4 years ago. And they had 400 musicians playing the song
all at once
in this giant square. I have to say it was pretty awesome to watch. Like, I don't know how many of each instrument, but it looked like there were like 50 drummers and, you know, probably more, and, you know, like 200 guitar players and people singing and... Amazing. What a funny thing for that band. Like, they must just be pissing themselves laughing. if their story is true about how it originated.
Well, I mean, the riff where it goes kind of quiet is very catchy. I mean, it's in my head right now, and I just heard it, you know, you just played it, you know, an hour ago or however long we've been on.
Yeah.
Or half an hour, but I get why it was a hit.
Yeah.
It's an earworm.
And it's funny because, despite the fact that it was seemingly sort of tossed off, with not a lot of thought, I watched a video last night of a guy dissecting the guitar part. And there's actually, I kind of love this when something you think sounds really simple, but there's actually a lot more going on than, you know, you would initially think. And, it's not jazz, but there's some really interesting choices that he made. Like, I think that this guy, Graham Coxon, is kind of a genius. I love his guitar playing. I find has a very unique style, and he's very humble about it. And I don't think he's routinely recognized for his ability, but it was neat to see some of these videos where people were dissecting it, how he came up with this sound. And there's more to it than just a rat pedal.
Right.
It's pretty cool to see that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I have no reason to doubt, I mean, why a record company liked it.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I guess you're a bit less familiar with it, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is it doesn't seem like that weird a song, but it's so interesting that the band's first reaction was, there's no way this is, I guess, maybe based on the kind of music that they had been playing already, which, you know, was Britpop, and some, you know, early days was influenced by the Manchester scene, and some was quite, you know, orchestrated and like these, you know, beautiful pop gems or whatever. For this to come out and be a big hit for them must have been pretty interesting. I think that's down to Graham Coxon on a couple of reasons that he, first of all, that he completely went in a different direction in his musical taste and started following more what some American bands like Pavement were doing.
Right.
And, but then also to hear this acoustic version of the song, speed it up, decide, you know, a little bit about how it was going to be presented. I give him a lot of credit for that, but maybe that's just my bias. Cause I find in a lot of, songwriting partnerships that I think that a lot of the stuff that gets the guitar player traditionally in a band is very influential. Like, I would argue the Smiths, you know, obviously Johnny Marr was a huge part of what made that partnership work. Like, such an interesting guitarist. Find their sound, and there's no one like him. Like, I started learning some of his parts at early pandemic, because I just wanted something to focus on that
right.
would take me out of thinking about things, and learning a song that isn't yours is actually a really good way to do that. And I was amazed by how difficult the parts were and how interesting they were.
Yeah, it's true. You get these far out songs that have the amount of work that goes into them is deceptive. Like a new classical song, 70s. What's it called? It was the theme from the movie The Deer Hunter. It's called Cavatina. I think it's called. You've heard it. Everyone's heard it.
Yeah.
But it sounds like the easiest, mellowest thing. But to get that easy, mellow flow, you're ripping your hands apart and stretching. The song was not written for ease of playing in mind. It was written for the listener to hear. Mm-hmm. And to get that effect, it requires a lot of strength and training and stuff to get there.
It's funny how often that's the way it is, and even like you think playing songs slowly that's easier, but it's not, because your timing is more, it's more important that your timing is perfect, you know, instead of like if you're just kind of riffing really fast, people don't notice if your timing's off as much, you know.
Right. Yeah, no, slow. You need much more precision.
Yeah, there were some other bands in that era that, you know, they tried to take a bite out of the Britpop battles. Suede was one of them, and Manic Street Preachers, those bands.
Yeah, not my area.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, you may have a little bit of a gap with some of this era of British music, seems like.
Well, yeah, late 90s, I was living in Mexico, for one thing, and I wouldn't have been, familiar with it all. There are definitely gaps.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, just being in a completely different location, and I'm sure being exposed to completely different music.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, they listen to obviously English-speaking music, but I just didn't, a lot of it didn't come across my, my peripheral, sound or anything like that. I just didn't hear it. I heard, some weird things. I remember one that was a big hit was Jamiroquai's Canned Heat. That was a big hit in Mexico for some reason. I heard it all the time. And it's like, I thought it was a Stevie Wonder song because he had the Stevie Wonder voice down to a science. It's like, no, it's not him at all. It took a long time for me to figure that out. It's just an instant gut reaction that I get.
I never cared for him.
Why not?
I don't know. It doesn't appeal to me. That, especially that big hit of his.
It's Canned Heat, or is there another one you're thinking of?
I don't know. There's like one song that I think of when I think of Jamiroquai.
Well, sing it. Let's hear.
No, I refuse.
Your Canadian reserve is showing through, Tom.
It's true. It's funny. I'm out here in the woods all by myself, and still my reserve is coming through.
Yeah, except you're broadcasting to thousands and thousands, if not millions of listeners at this point for our podcast.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Well, we can't, I think it's finally time for me to point out to our listeners how uncanny it is that whenever you sing a song and the song gets inserted into the podcast, how your pitch is bang on.
Just genius, Tom.
Freakish. It's actually weird. It freaks me out. It makes me think you're possibly an alien or a robot or something.
Yeah, I never even noticed such a thing because I couldn't carry a tune with a handle.
Which is so interesting because every time when I bring in a song that you start singing, it's always in the right relative key. And, that's... people refer to that as perfect pitch.
Right.
But I'm not going to give you too much credit because I know
it'll go to my
because
head,
I know
right?
that I know that within the song, like you're within, once you figure out the relative pitch, like your pitch isn't perfect.
No, God, no.
But you do manage to hit the key of a song. And you know, one could argue, well, if it was your podcast and you'd just been listening to those songs, well, fair enough. But in a lot of cases, I'm presenting the song and it's a song you probably haven't heard in 10, 20, 30 years. And somehow you still, it's, I don't know, man.
Pitch me one.
You are? I think you are from Mars.
Pitch me one.
Okay. Oh God. You know any Supertramp?
Sure. I mean, who doesn't?
How about, Logical Song?
When I was young, they taught me how to be sensible. A criminal, constipation, all the logical. See if it matches. There you go.
I have a feeling it is.
I don't know. What?
If it isn't, I'm going to pitch shift it.
When I was young, they taught me how to be sensible. A criminal, constipation, all the
yeah, there you go. Yeah, but, yeah. Just, why does anyone need no, to practice
record,
singing?
For the record, I've never done that. But
oh, you mean like on your own I've recording never had some to. Things?
Yeah. No. I mean, I've never had to do that to you.
Oh,
I didn't want to set that up and be like, oh, he's just been pitch shifting it the whole time.
Well, I've had to do it to you the entire time. So there you go. No, you don't sing.
I don't
so
sing.
Much.
Yeah, I know.
Not so much. There's a couple things you did on a couple, but
you know, Ty, I'm weirdly shy about my voice, and it's actually it's a kind of a funny thing because a lot of people in my bands, they try to get me to sing, and I've always been very shy about that, and I think it comes down to one thing that happened in my childhood that completely traumatized me.
The girl you're into said, "What a crappy ass voice."
No, I wanted to sing. Like, I remember telling my mother, "I want to be a singer." Like, I thought I was.
And
gonna
I,
be a singer.
I remember that as when you were an early teen.
Yeah, and so I did there was a talent contest, and I remember learning a few songs with my friend, and one of them was U2 October.
Okay.
That he was playing on piano. I think he had a piano in his basement, Mark McKee. And then, no, it couldn't have been him. No, it was someone else. It was this guy, Daniel. And I think he could play, he played guitar. And one of the ones was Joan Jett, I Love Rock and Roll. And I think that's the one I chose. And then when we were singing it to the class, and when it came time to sing, I just couldn't do it. And everyone was so sweet. Everyone's like trying to encourage me to sing, and I was just like, I was so shy, I couldn't do it.
Of all the songs that aren't you, I'd put that pretty high on the list.
Well, it's an odd choice. It's definitely an odd choice. And I wonder if it had to do with the repertoire of the guy I was playing with, that maybe he kind of only knew like three songs and that was one of them, and that was the lesser of evils maybe.
Yeah, well, let's be fair here. I mean, one's voice is one's identity. You're putting a lot out there.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, I see this in foreign, you know, people speaking in foreign language, people are very sensitive about their language skills in another language. And they're also very sensitive. You're like, if you're really learning to speak it to sound like the country, the place you're going or whatever, and you speak with a, you know, pronunciation that's solid, it's like you're losing a piece of your identity because it's not your voice.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I mean, so singers are inspired. I mean, some of them may have just natural skills. They've always been confident about it, but sometimes, you know, it's just, you got to put yourself out there because that's your voice.
I agree. And I can't think of any other thing that is more putting yourself out there when you're singing to people something that you wrote about your life. Like, that is a remarkable thing to have the courage to do that, knowing that people can easily trash you for any number of reasons.
That's a good point.
Think about something that's as soul-bearing as that. I can't think of anything.
Yeah, it'd be one of those things, especially if it were really dark or something like that, it'd be one of those things that you had to do it. You know, you have to get it out there. Mm-hmm. Because, or you're just, you know, you've got to express yourself. It's just too painful not to do it, even though it's painful to do it.
Right.
Leonard and Cohen's coming to mind here for some reason.
You know who's coming to mind for me is Thom Yorke.
Okay.
Someone who is painfully shy, seemingly, probably very introverted. The whole band, really, you know, like maybe that's the thing. Maybe that's what makes them amazing is because they're very much out of their comfort zone and bearing themselves in a way that is remarkable. Maybe that's part of the magic.
And shifting just briefly back to the voice and identity thing, mm-hmm. Watergate, you know, early 70s, the United States, Richard Nixon, a lot of the tapes that would have, that were his undoing, you know, he could have destroyed,
mm-hmm.
but that was his voice
mm.
to just, you know, his legacy, everything. He couldn't bring himself to destroy, you know, these, you know, really nasty conversations that were going to possibly land them in jail.
In just a few seconds we have left now, and there's almost just time for yes or no. Are you sorry you didn't burn the tapes?
You know, interestingly enough, everybody in Europe that I talked to said, why didn't you burn the tapes? And the answer is, I probably should have, but mainly...
That's interesting.
Yeah, so, I mean, our voice is, yeah, it's so close to who we are, and We take great care with it a lot of times.
Yeah, well, it's very frustrating to some of my bandmates that I won't chip in background vocals, but they accept it.
All right, here's the challenge for next episode. We each sing something a cappella. You pick the song.
Wow.
We can do our whiskey challenge that night if you wish. Where we were considering...
I don't know if there's enough whiskey in Canada for that.
It's time to break down this reserve that has just been holding you back, Tom. Enough's enough.
Yeah? Is it going to be a whole new era for me?
Or how about this? You want to pick one for me? I'll pick one for you.
Oh, God.
Or are you going to chicken out, aren't you?
Maybe.
All right.
We'll see. I'll entertain it.
Okay.
You're really pushing me. I thought this was just like going to be a like nice conversation between friends, Ty. You're really pushing the envelope.
Well, I'm still waiting for Smoke on the Water on the steel pedal. Steel. And I told you I was going to sing over top of it in perfect pitch, apparently, too. Smoke on the Water. So we've got to incorporate that into the repertoire at some point.
Yeah.
And get sued by Deep Purple. For just plain ruining their song.
Thanks for tuning in to TNT's Hit Songs from Mars. We hope you enjoyed yourself and learned a few things along the way.
For a complete list of songs you heard in this episode, visit us at hsfm.buzzsprout.com. We hope you'll support the artists we featured by purchasing their music.
If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and you'll receive new episodes as soon as they become available. While you're at it, if you could give us a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts, that would really help us out. We would like to thank The Reverb Syndicate for providing the theme song for our podcast. They have an extensive catalog of tunes just as rockin' as the one you hear here.
Here, here.
You can find them at thereverbsyndicate.ca and on Facebook, SoundCloud, and Bandcamp, which typically pays artists the most. We would also like to thank Eric Minot for designing our podcast icon. You can find his design and illustration work on Instagram at Minot Graphics. That's MINOGRAPHX. You can connect with us on Twitter at SongsFromMars and at hsfm.buzzsprout.com.
Feel free to disagree, praise, correct, and chastise us.
We would also love to hear your idea of a hit song from Mars and why you think it fits the mold. Even better, if you felt like recording a voice memo and sending it our way, you can email us at hitsongsfrommars@gmail.com. We may even feature it on the show. Until next time, Earthlings.